The Linux Reality Podcast is sponsored by O'Reilly Media, spreading the knowledge of innovators through its books, online services, magazines, and conferences. Visit them today at O'Reilly.com. Hey everybody, this is Chess Griffin and welcome back to the Linux Reality Podcast. This is episode number 74. And in this episode, we've got an interview with Will Backman. He is the host of the BSD Talk podcast, and we talk about BSD. And I think this is kind of neat because, you know, as I think I've mentioned in previous episodes over the last 8 or 9 months or so, I've been sort of playing with the BSDs and I've really gotten to enjoy them and sort of appreciate what the BSDs can do. And it's just, I love Unix-like operating systems and I enjoy Linux and BSDs. And I haven't yet had a chance to tackle Solaris, but that's next on my list. So I thought it'd be fun to talk to Will and have him kind of tell us a little bit about the BSD. So that's coming up here in just one sec. First, though, I did want to mention, I touched on this previously. Next week is I'm going to be off, at least next week, and it might even be the week after. We'll have to see. But you know, there's a good chance it's just going to be 1 week. So I will be off for 1 week. We're doing some home renovations and sort of my office where I do my recording, my podcast studio, such as it is going to be dismantled temporarily while we do some painting and things like that. So I will be back the week, at least, you know, should be the week after that, but it might be 2 weeks. We'll have to see. So, but thank you for hanging in there. And let's see. I don't think I've got any other announcements. So let's get right to this interview with Will Backman. All right. Well, tonight I'm speaking with Will Backman. Will, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for making the time. I really do appreciate it. And I think this will be really interesting. I know we'll talk about some neat technologies and the BSD operating systems, but I wanted to talk about you first. You're a fellow podcaster.
Yes, I am. I produce the, I guess if you want to call it produce, the BSD Talk podcast.
Can you tell me a little bit about the podcast? You know, when you got started and how long you've been going and sort of what led you into it?
Sure. I started December 2005 and I had a job I still have this job that has me driving all over the state. The main office is an hour away, although we have about 9 offices across the state. And I'm in my car a lot, just driving. And so I was looking for something to listen to, and I was always listening to a lot of podcasts. I started listening to Leo Laporte's podcasts because I did watch a lot of the screensavers, although just the tail end of it. And I noticed that there were all kinds of podcasts about Linux and other operating systems, Macintosh, but I didn't see anything for the BSDs. And so I figured, well, if there's a need, you fill it. That's kind of the open source philosophy. And so I started a podcast.
What is sort of your background with Unix-like operating systems? You mentioned your job. Is that something that you work with in your day job? Did you have some you know, knowledge in this area before starting the podcast? It sounds like it from the podcast that you kind of knew what you were talking about.
I fake it pretty well. You know, my goal is to have everybody fooled, but you just have to ask a few good questions and let the smart people do the real talking.
Like I'm doing now.
That's right. when it comes to my early history with Unix operating systems, I actually was involved in video production and special effects as a high school job down in New York. And special effects at the time were primarily in the world of Silicon Graphics workstations, which use a version of Unix called Irix. And from there, I did animation and other things. And so that let me see a little bit of Unix, although I wasn't heavily involved in the animation of it. It was just there. You know, I was the high school student sweeping the floors and putting tools in the right place. But Unix was there, and it piqued my interest. And then I ended up having a friend who started a bulletin board service. This is before the internet, back when you had to dial into somebody's computer in their basement. You didn't get to talk to everyone on the internet. And they eventually moved over to an internet service provider when they hooked up to the internet. And they needed some what they call radius authentication servers that authenticate your username and password when you dial up. And they were having trouble with the software on Windows NT. It would crash all the time, and he could never take a vacation or go to dinner without things crashing. This was back in NT 4, prior to about Service Pack 5 or 6, where it wasn't as stable, perhaps, as it could have been. And the engineers who made the modem pools suggested that he try running their software on this strange operating system called Linux. Because I had done a little playing around with Unix operating systems, I helped them set up a Linux server as a Radius authentication server and just started playing from there.
Now, when was this about? Was this you mentioned NT Service Pack 4, so that's, what, 96 or 7? A little bit later.
Yeah, I'd say it's somewhere around the time. I'm a little foggy when it comes to the exact dates, but that sounds about right. I'd have to go back and, you know, try and mark the years. They all kind of bleed one into another.
And was this sort of, you know, interest in these operating systems, is that something that led you into your current position? Is that what you get to work on a daily basis?
Yeah. I'm a network administrator for a nonprofit here in Maine. We have a variety of offices across the state. And when I started working there, they actually had a mixture of Windows, Linux, and Novell. Basically, the right tool for the right job, or quite often the software that you want to use dictates the platform that you're going to run it on. So it was a mixed environment, and they needed somebody who had some experience with a variety of environments. And helping out at an ISP, you definitely gain some tolerance for a variety of environments just because the end users are always calling up with different operating systems on their computers, whether it be Mac or PC or whatever. And the servers that you run at an ISP are quite often a variety. And I've also, as part of that, I started teaching in 1999 at the University of Maine at the Computer Science Department. And there I teach courses on TCP/IP networking and Unix and general computing stuff.
Now, were you able to, you know, bring these operating systems home? did they pass the wife test?
I actually love all operating systems. So at home, the only operating system I don't run anymore is Windows. But I have Apple computers and PCs now running Ubuntu Linux, which seem to pass the wife test most easily. And unfortunately, once the wife starts using it enough, or other people in the household, your ability to change shrinks because you don't want to mess up their life too much. So it's pretty much stuck with Ubuntu Linux recently.
Yeah, I can relate entirely with that. We have one Mac OS X. It's an old G4 that my wife uses, and I've recently got her using Ubuntu. But it's difficult even making that transition, especially when she has a fair amount invested in iTunes Music.
Yeah, one of the things that started dictating my choice of operating systems was the fact that I was running both PCs and Macs, and so I was always looking for a single operating system that could run on both pieces of hardware. And for a while, Red Hat was supporting both i386 and PowerPC, and then that seemed to slack off, and they decided maybe they didn't want to support PowerPC. Ubuntu came onto the scene, and they were supporting PowerPC, so I thought I'd give them a try, although recently they seem to have dropped support of that. But, I like to play. I love them all. I also have an Amiga. I have some Silicon Graphics workstations, an AIX server, anything I can get my hands on.
Oh, it sounds like you've got some fun toys there. Why don't we turn to the BSDs in general? As you know, this podcast is primarily aimed at Linux. But to be honest with you, listening to your podcast has piqued my interest in the BSDs again. Do you mind kind of, you know, taking a few minutes and maybe sketch out just a brief history of the BSDs?
Sure. And I can't really claim to be a historian on the BSDs, and I would urge people to go check out maybe the Wikipedia articles on the BSDs. That would give a much more comprehensive and, more importantly, an accurate history of the BSDs. But I can do my best to summarize it for people. Essentially, BSD, the first letter B, stands for Berkeley, as in the University of California, Berkeley. And AT&T, which was the company that originally developed Unix back in the 70s, due to, as far as I remember, some antitrust issues, they were prohibited from entering the computer operating system market. And so they were licensing Unix to universities inexpensively. And back at that time, the source code was always available for operating systems. And the people at Berkeley did a lot to improve AT&T's code. Certain things that were developed at the time in the late 70s and early 80s were things such as TCP/IP networking, which is the language that's used by computers on the Internet. So the Internet and the BSDs really grew up together. And at some point, AT&T entered the operating system market again and complained that Berkeley was distributing their own versions of AT&T's operating system, and that it contained portions of AT&T's proprietary code. And so there's this period of time where Berkeley had to rewrite portions of their operating system and make sure that BSD was completely clean and didn't contain any AT&T code. That essentially was BSD Unix. This was well before Intel chips, well before i386. So we're talking, VAX and other bizarre, very expensive architectures. These were computers that were millions of dollars. I don't know if they were millions. I wasn't around back then. But they were, very expensive, usually only owned by large corporations or universities. And so the people who were able to work on them were, professionals or people who did this as a full-time profession. It's hard to, I'm not really exactly sure when in that whole timeline, Linux was coming around, I think, 1991. But prior to that, Richard Stallman, when he was starting the GNU project, I think the BSDs and GNU were around at the same time, and I'm not quite sure why Stallman, who was looking for a free version of Unix, didn't join forces with the BSD operating system, or why this separate line started. Who knows? But eventually, when Linux came on the scene, I'm not sure whether the legal issues around AT&T and BSD provided an opening for Linux to happen, or what happened. But from there, the BSDs were eventually ported to the i386 architecture. And that, really spawned the BSDs that we know today, such as FreeBSD, NetBSD, and subsequently OpenBSD, which is a fork from NetBSD. They share perhaps a common ancestry, but at this point their code bases have diverged pretty significantly. There are a lot of developers who work on all the projects or a couple of the projects. And then some later offshoots from those major three would be things like Dragonfly BSD or Desktop BSD or PC BSD. Dragonfly BSD is a fork of FreeBSD. There were different ideas as to how to approach multiprocessing. So what's nice about forks is it allows you to explore different possibilities. PC BSD and Desktop BSD, I guess you could call them separate distributions of FreeBSD. Really, they're stock FreeBSD with some easy installers and some additional utilities to make them a little more desktop-friendly, because the BSDs have traditionally focused on the server. So I don't know if that's a coherent history or what you're looking for, but that's the best I can do.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's really helpful. And can you kind of, those different projects that you mentioned, FreeBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, and you did this a little bit with PCBSD, but for those, I guess, the primary ones there, maybe the big three, can you talk a little bit about them, maybe the philosophies, what the project goals are, just in a big picture sense?
Sure, I can give you that as I understand it. Of course, I can't speak for the individual projects. I'm not a developer or one of founders. But from what I've observed, I guess you could say that FreeBSD is commonly associated with being popular. It is one of the most popular of the BSDs. And it's also commonly used as a server, web serving, routing, other kinds of things. It really has a lot of developers and a lot of users, and it's just a popular, solid operating system. NetBSD focused on being as portable as possible. And one of the sayings they have is, yes, it runs NetBSD. NetBSD runs on a huge number of platforms. It's very popular in the embedded market, maybe photocopiers or other small devices. There was a point in time where some of the developers had some disagreements, and so OpenBSD was forked from NetBSD. Like NetBSD, it does support a wide variety of platforms, although not as many as NetBSD. That's not its primary focus. OpenBSD currently has a reputation for focusing on security. I think that given limited developer time, budgets, and other kinds of things, when the OpenBSD developers have to choose between implementing security features or implementing other features, they have a tendency to go for security features. So that's kind of my overview of them.
What's your sense in, again, just taking a high level view of things? And I understand, you know, you don't speak for any of the projects, but just from interviewing people, what's your sense of the BSD community today?
My sense of the BSD community is perhaps a little more technical or maybe a little more professional. I don't see a lot of BSD being brought to households necessarily, you know, that being the focus. So I almost think of the BSD community as being a little more academic. And I don't know whether that's part of its academic roots, given that it started at a university.
Well, and the other interesting thing, or I should say another interesting thing about the BSDs, from what I understand, is that unlike other Unix-like operating systems, they are a complete operating system. Is that fair to say?
Sort of. You know, you hear that said a lot. I think where that stems from is that Linux is a kernel, and only a kernel. And when a lot of people, when they say Linux, they actually mean a particular distribution. But in the early days of Linux, you had to take kernel, and then you needed things like compilers and a command line interface and a variety of other things. And those were quite often bundled with a Linux kernel, and they were most often taken from the GNU project. They basically started from the top down, the user land utilities compilers working their way towards a kernel. Linus Torvalds was working on a kernel and used the GNU user land utilities, and people put them together. But they aren't necessarily all developed in the same CVS source code repository. The BSDs, on the other hand, the kernel and the utility LS, which is what you use to list the contents of a directory, those were all developed as part of the operating system. It's not the Linux kernel and the GNU LS. BSD has their own version of LS, their own version of PS, and those all hang out in the same source code repository or source code tree. But you can't, I don't think you can really call the BSDs a complete operating system, because so many pieces of it are the same pieces that Linux uses. We all use the Apache web server. We all use SendMail. We all use the X Windows system. So in a certain sense, the BSD that you use, similar to Linux, is actually a mixture of a variety of projects.
I think I've heard a couple of the developers mention on your show, or maybe I've read it somewhere, that they're actually looking to replace some of the pieces of the tool chain, or perhaps the user land, that are not developed in-house, so to speak, that they're looking to replace those with, I guess, BSD-specific replacements. Is that something that is occurring?
Yeah, and I think that's quite often a licensing issue. The GPL and the BSD license, or the BSD copyright, are compatible mostly. Although it's more like a one-way street, because the BSD license says, here's our code, do whatever you want with it, feel free to make it a commercial project, you don't have to give anything back. Meanwhile, the GPL has a few more requirements. And so it can be difficult to take GPL code and make it part of a BSD system, but it's simple to take BSD code and make it part of a Linux system. And there's also been a tendency to take the GPL or other similar licenses and modify them just slightly. So there's a proliferation of licenses, such as the Mozilla license, or, there's a few other projects that have taken these licenses and tweaked them slightly. And for the people in the BSD projects who are purists when it comes to the BSD license, they're unwilling to use certain software where the license is incompatible, and that pushes them to try and produce software that's under the BSD license.
Well, it's actually interesting you mentioned that. That sort of segues well into really the next thing I wanted to talk about, which was the BSD license. Again, listening to your show, it's really given me a new understanding of the BSD license, and it seems like when compared to the GPL, they each have advantages and disadvantages, and obviously there's one camp that likes one and another camp that likes another, sort of like a VI versus Emacs type of dispute. But in talking to developers, but also in your talks with people who are outside these projects, who are maybe with other companies or other projects that have decided to go with the BSD license, what's been your sense from these people on what the advantages of the BSD license are?
I guess you could say there's a couple categories of people. There are the end users, and I don't know whether the license matters too much to a lot of end users. They're just happy to get the code for free, but they're not necessarily going to be doing anything in the sense of redistributing or developing their own products out of it. So the end users may not care so much. Both the GPL and the BSD license grant them the privileges that they want. Then you may have other developers, and certain developers, you know, it's just a philosophical question, like you said, VI versus Emacs. And I think that certain licenses speak to you, and for the people who like the BSD license, I think that they like, one, the simplicity of it, the fact that it's very easy to understand, it's only a couple sentences long. And I think that they also like to give that away. If someone wants to make it a commercial success, they're happy to have that happen. I think also a third category of people would be commercial companies who want to make a commercial product out of something. And I mean, obviously, the GPL hasn't been a barrier to commercial products. There's a lot of companies that have been very successful. You know, TiVo and Linksys, they're all using GPL software and Linux software just fine. And it may be because of the GPL that we're more aware of the companies that are using GPL software because of the requirement to give back. Meanwhile, in the BSD community, it may be a little less obvious which commercial companies are using it because they aren't required to give anything back or even announce that they're using it, although you quite often see them popping up on mailing lists or whatever. But I can imagine that if I were a commercial company or a small startup looking at the BSD license, there would be less uncertainty around it. And, you know, it's a couple sentences, easy to understand. And I do know that I can mingle my own code in it, in the code that I get from the BSD projects, and I might have to be a little more careful with the GPL code. But that's just my personal bias, I guess.
It is something that sort of gets at the heart of you know, for a lot of these developers, it seems to be very important to them which license their software is going to be released under.
Yeah, I've heard the saying that the greatest tyranny is only one choice. So I just think it's wonderful that there are a variety of choices. And to me, that's what's important, choice. Not to mention, you can almost say that I have operating system attention deficit disorder. I love to try them all. So the fact that I've got BSDs to play with and Linux to play with and Amiga to play with and OS2, whatever you want to get your hands on, I think it's all wonderful.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Speaking of BSD and Linux, for the folks listening to this podcast, obviously a lot of them are Linux users. There's obviously a lot of folks who are Windows users and Macintosh users. What are some of the attractive features of the BSDs? And I'm not picking on I don't want to single out any one, but I guess, you know, why would someone want to try one of the BSDs?
Yeah, if I took it from my own perspective, what was attractive about the BSDs for me, in general, I think that playing with the BSDs feels similar to trying a new distribution. And that's fun in itself. A new version of Debian comes out and you download the ISOs and you install it. You see what it's like, or the new version of Fedora, or maybe a new version of Gentoo or Puppy Linux. And so to me, the BSDs were attractive because it's another cool thing to put on my computer and see what happens. Other things that might be attractive, different operating systems and even distributions seem to have better support for different varieties of hardware. Quite often you have a laptop or a desktop where one distribution or one operating system seems to make 90% of the hardware work, and a different distribution makes 100% of the hardware work. And depending on your hardware, one distribution may be better than the other. So if you do have perhaps a computer that doesn't seem to want to work properly, give another distribution a try, or give the BSDs a try. See how it works for you. Something else that I like about the BSDs is their focus on the command line. And I'm a big proponent of the command line. It's perhaps a little daunting for some people, but I feel there are so many advantages, at least from a network administration and systems management perspective, to the command line. Obviously, for a desktop PC where all you want to do is browse the web, you may never want to see the command line, but I really love the simplicity of the BSDs. I feel sometimes that at least some of the Linux distributions, because they have started to rely on graphical utilities, let's say Network Manager, which is a new Linux network manager for your wireless cards, that graphical utility ends up creating some complexity under the hood. And when that utility goes bonkers, I've always found that it's difficult to go in and fix it. And so I feel that the graphical utilities end up, they allow complexity under the hood. And the BSDs, because they seem to primarily focus on the command line, they strive to make doing things on the command line as simple as possible, because there isn't a graphical utility that you can fall back into. So that's another feature that I like. There's also, just some interesting utilities and tools that you can get out of the BSDs. The PF firewall being, a nice firewall that's available on all the BSDs. The package management systems are really nice. Look at NetBSD's package source and the ability to have the same software on a variety of operating systems. Just like FreeBSD's ports and packages is something that the Gentoo project liked, and they modeled Gentoo on. So I think that if you're a Gentoo user, take a look at the BSDs. So, those are some of the things that come off the top of my head. I could probably keep rambling, but in general, it's just something new to try, and it's something fun.
What are some of the challenges that perhaps a desktop user might face in using one of the BSDs? I mean, one that seems to always pop up is flash support. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the other challenges that folks may face?
Yeah, obviously any proprietary software is a problem. Proprietary software limits your freedom. A perfect example, I'll run Linux on my i386, and then I want to go run Linux on my PowerPC machine, but guess what? There isn't flash for Linux on PowerPC. You have to run OS X. So anytime you have proprietary software, you're stuck using the hardware that they're willing to support. You're also stuck using the operating systems that they're willing to support. So flash support, Skype, other kinds of things aren't natively written for the BSDs. Now, the BSDs are capable of allowing for software emulation. They can run software from other operating systems, and their Linux support is pretty good. So flash and Skype and other things do run under the BSDs. They're just using the Linux binaries. And the operating system fakes these programs out, makes them think they're running on Linux, and they're able to run fairly well.
Now, that Linux emulation layer, from what I understand, it's not really emulation. Is that right? Isn't it similar to Wine in that it's trying to translate system calls between the two different kinds of operating systems? Is that more or less the way it works?
Yeah, you're not running a Linux kernel, and you're not running a virtual machine. You're just, Unix systems are fairly similar, and there's a fairly standard set of system calls. And where the system calls differ, system calls are just a way of a program making a request of the operating system or the kernel. When those requests are slightly different, you can just listen for those different requests and translate them into your native system calls. At least that's how I understand it.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the PF firewall from OpenBSD, which I think is now available on the other BSDs. What other features like that are kind of unique? I mean, I guess I'm thinking of maybe FreeBSD jails. Can you maybe talk about some of the unique features that you kind of only find in the BSDs?
Sure, and jails aren't necessarily unique. The term, I guess, is something that's used in FreeBSD, and that's a way of emulating or not, you know, almost creating a new machine, but it's not a separate kernel. It's a separate user land, so that if you're doing virtual hosting, I guess the best example I could come up with, I don't remember the name of the company, I think it was in Italy, but they were doing virtual hosting, and they were using the Apache web server, and unfortunately the Apache web server runs as the Apache user, an untrusted Apache user, so it's pretty difficult to bust into the Apache web server and from there leverage your way into the operating system. But in a virtual hosting environment, if you can bust into the Apache user, because all the hosted websites are running under the Apache user, you can get into other people's websites. And so you have what's called a mass defacement, where one person's poorly written PHP application allows a bad person to go ahead and modify other people's websites. What a jail does on FreeBSD is create almost a whole new server, so that it can have its own IP address, it's got its own version of Apache running, and everything's completely separate. And so that gives perhaps an additional layer of defense that's nice.
That's one thing I haven't played around with yet, but it does sound really interesting. It's sort of like a light virtual machine, perhaps, but it's a little bit, but it's more than a change root environment. Is that right?
Right, because there's pretty much an entire operating system there, not just the program that's running.
Going back to the some of the issues with the BSDs, I guess some of the challenges. Couple things that have leapt out to me from some of your interviews that I found interesting was some of the difficulties in porting other free software or maybe to put it another way, it seems like that there are certain projects. I think maybe Network Manager is one. I remember the FreeBSD GNOME guy, I think you had on your show at one point, was talking about some of the challenges that they're now facing, that in that some of the free software that's out there is sort of being written for Linux, that makes it difficult to translate to the BSDs. Is that something that is becoming increasingly common, do you think?
Yeah, I kind of had that assumption, and as I talk to people, cert projects are that way, although I think there's hope in other projects, so perhaps it's a mixed picture depending on the project. There are definitely certain technologies that Linux is starting to develop that are fairly Linux-specific, like the dbus message system that allows, you know, it's common in GNOME, and I think KDE might be adopting it. Pretty much any time you're starting to reach into the kernel to do stuff, Linux and BSD are different enough where that's difficult. But, you know, I think that, you know, given that they're open source projects, as long as there's developers on the BSD side who are willing or have the time or the money to do the work, then, you know, those differences can be fixed. And so I don't think it's a major problem.
And hopefully it's something that people are really thinking about. I happened to notice the other day with the release of the KDE 4 live CD, I think it was a beta release, but I think it was in a live CD. I haven't tried it yet, but I was reading some of the notes and some of the comments by the KDE team, and they seem to indicate in several places that they are, as part of this complete rewrite of a lot of the KDE libraries and tools, that they're really trying to make it Unix portable, which seemed to me to be almost something speaking to this issue a little bit.
Yeah, and you know, people always claim that stuff that's written for Unix is quite portable. All you have to do is do a configure make and make install and it should work. And I think that works for very simple programs, but it does get a little more complicated, especially when you have a lot of dependencies, such as maybe a dependency on the Advanced Linux Sound Architecture, which is one of the sound daemons that's available, and it's very Linux specific. And you know, so it could be just some of these dependencies. You can get around it by ripping out those dependencies and say, well, this thing works, but it doesn't have sound or something like that. Don't quite know where I'm going with the end of this answer. But
well, no, I think you're right. And I think the ALSA issue is part of what's holding back Flash 9, from what I understand. I think Adobe went with ALSA for the Flash 9 player for Linux, and I think that's becoming part of the problem of even getting it to work with the Linux layer on the BSDs. From at least as far as I can tell, it seems to be part of the problem.
Yeah, before there was OSS, I think that's what it was called, and that was very platform neutral. But unfortunately, the author of that project either changed it to proprietary. There was something in the licensing that caused the Linux people to come with up with ALSA. And I guess recently OSS has been re-released under the GPL or something like that. So there's always kind of this confusion around sound daemons, and KDE had its own. And yeah, it's a mess with sound.
One thing you touched on briefly that I do want to just take a minute to kind of expand on a little bit is the package management in the BSDs, the ports and packages system. Can you kind of describe that system a little bit?
Sure. And this is probably another feature that differentiates the BSDs from Linux. The BSDs have a clear separation between the base system and the ports and packages. And this can be a good thing and a bad thing, depending on your perspective. The Linux distributions quite often use a whatever package management system it is for the entire operating system, and they really don't treat the base system and add-ons separately, which is very nice because you manage your whole system using the same tools. The BSDs use perhaps a cumbersome mechanism for keeping the base operating system up to date, and that involves usually a lot of compiling and patching. Meanwhile, add-on software, ports and packages, is usually very easy to install. They're pre-compiled, and you just say, hey, install this, and magically it shows up, similar to an apt-get or yum install. Sometimes it frustrates me that I can't manage the BSD's base systems the same way I can manage their ports and packages. But at the same time, I like knowing that when I install a port or a package, it's not going to monkey with my base system. There's not going to be some dependencies that flow down into some very core, critical parts of my operating system. So I can install and uninstall and have these dependencies come and go in the ports and packages, and I'll know that my base system isn't going to be wrecked by that. So I kind of like that feature.
Yeah, that's been something that's been sort of a real eye-opener for me in the brief time I've spent with the BSDs, is that separation. I find it very interesting. And is it something that theoretically, I realize this probably couldn't really be done, that you could almost wipe out your entire USR local directory and be back at a base install? I mean, more or less, is that sort of the way it works?
Yeah, in theory, your packages shouldn't be modifying files in your system's Etsy directory. They shouldn't be putting binary files or programs in your user bin or SBIN. Everything that you add on outside of the base system should be in its own area.
Is the ports and packages system, is it something that's used by pretty much all the BSDs, or do some of them have their own kind of unique package management systems?
Right now, they all use their own, although they're given similar terminology. The original FreeBSD ports and packages is probably the most popular, and NetBSD and OpenBSD modeled their ports and packages systems on that, although they're a different code base, they're different utilities, even though they may share the same name. And then NetBSD has switched over to something completely different with their own package management system called PackageSource. The general philosophy behind all of them is that you ask it to install a package, all there are some directories with some makefiles, and these makefiles go and fetch the actual tarballs, the software that it needs to compile, and also fetches patches that are needed in order to modify the original code to work on the BSDs, and then it will go ahead and install it for you. So that's the general gist of how it works.
And then PCBSD has its own separate packaging system, the PBIs. Is that right?
Yeah, it uses a mixture. It has the FreeBSD base system ports and packages for some of the undercarriage of the operating system. But then they wanted to create a package management system that I guess is similar to the way Windows has their installers, where you just double-click on something and it installs. But they also wanted the features of the OS X bundles where everything is under a single directory. So it gives you the ability to do a double-click install, and everything, including libraries and dependencies, all remain in a single folder. So it's much easier to install and uninstall.
Yeah, I remember trying out PCBSD a few months ago, and it worked really well. The PBI system worked really well. I think that some people, you know, maybe don't like the fact that multiple versions of the same library could be installed in with separate PBIs, but that is kind of what the Macintosh OS X does, and it does work really well. I mean, it is pretty much a foolproof system.
Yeah, I think given most computers are single user and fairly powerful, it's not so much of a problem to have this duplication of libraries. I think on an older system with hundreds of users, when you launched Netscape, you only wanted to load these shared libraries into memory once, because then all 100 copies of Netscape that are running can share that single shared library. It's a little more efficient.
Well, Will, I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been just really fascinating, and I wholeheartedly recommend that folks try out the BSDs and play. I think you said at the very beginning that it's sort of like trying out a new Linux distribution, and it really has been that way for me. But is there anything, you know, about the BSDs or anything that maybe I forgot to ask you about or mention that you wanted to sort of bring up before we wrap up?
Sure. I guess I would encourage people to check out the BSD documentation. One, I guess, benefit of this unified system is that the documentation is very consistent and very clear. If you go to the FreeBSD website and check out the FreeBSD handbook, it's really comprehensive and it's really good, and it walks you through everything. You don't need to search around for how to do things, and you don't have different distributions doing things differently or this version or the next version being significantly different. So there's great documentation with the FreeBSD handbook. Same thing with NetBSD and OpenBSD. Their man pages are really good. You don't have the separation of info versus man versus HTML help files. They're really consistent with their man pages. So read the documentation. Definitely search the archives before you ask questions, and yeah, give these operating systems a try. They're a lot of fun, and it may have some benefit for whatever particular use you're using it for.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Will.
Yes, thank you for having me. It was great talking with you.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank Will again for coming on and taking a few minutes to talk to me about the BSDs. It's just fantastic. And I really encourage everyone to check out his podcast. I'll, of course, put a link to it in the show notes. It really is just a great podcast. I mean, it's just one of the nice things about his podcast is they're short. You know, they're maybe 5, 10, maybe 20 minutes at the most. He might have had one or two up to 30 minutes, but no more than that. And most of them are interviews with all kinds of BSD developers and users and hackers and writers and some, you know, third parties, you know, customers and other companies that use BSD. It's just really cool. And it's one that I really encourage you to check out and maybe go back and listen to, you know, some of the old episodes. This is one that I downloaded all of them, and it took me like, I don't know, a few weeks to catch up listening to all of them. I'm glad I did, because there's some great content in there. And Will just does a fantastic job of interviewing these people. And do, you know, check out the BSDs. PCBSD is a great BSD to start with. It's very sort of user-friendly, and it's got a really nice package management system. But yet it's also pretty standard FreeBSD under the hood. So once you kind of get used to it, you can use the FreeBSD ports and things like that. And the new version of PCBSD 1.4 is coming out soon, and it sounds like they've really added a lot of neat things to it. I think it's going to have Barrel by default, Flash working, Flash 7, that is, and NVIDIA, and maybe some other drivers and stuff like that. So they've really kind of tweaked it out to make it sort of friendly to the home user and the desktop user. That's one to play around with. Desktop BSD is another great one, as well as sort of the big three, you know, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, and NetBSD. So just cool things to talk about, cool technologies, and you just got to love Unix-like operating systems. At least I do. I just think they're really cool. And I'm not going to do any feedback or listener tips this week, push for time a little bit. So I think it's time to go ahead and wrap it up for this week. Okay. Okay, well, thanks again for tuning in, everybody. And please, as I said, listen to Will's podcast. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Let's see, as I mentioned in the beginning, I'm going to be off next week and possibly the week after, but probably just the 1 week. In the meantime, though, please feel free to continue sending me your listener feedback and tips and audio comments and audio questions. You can send any of that to linuxreality@gmail.com, either just a regular text email, or, of course, you can record an audio clip in your favorite recorder and attach it as an email and send it, or as, you know, send it as an attachment with your sending it to that email address. I can't even talk, but we've also got the Linux Reality listener hotlines and the forums, of course, linuxreality.com/forums, and the IRC channel on irc.freednode.net. It's /Linux Reality. I think that's going to do it for me for this week. Hope you all have a great week and a great weekend, and next week as well. And I'll catch you all in at least a week, maybe 2 weeks from now. See you later. Take care, everyone. This has been episode 74 of Linux Reality. Bye-bye.